You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, an amendment in the U.S. House of Representatives turned into a bit of a shouting match yesterday. We'll find out what happened coming up.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
A study looking at America's drunkest cities made waves online this week, and Wisconsin cities made up the majority of their top 20 list.
Also this week, Waukesha's plan to get its water from Lake Michigan move forward, and a U.S. representative from Wisconsin introduced a bill to reform asset forfeiture laws.
Robert Menser joins us now for a rundown on these stories. He's storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, good to have you back.
Hey, it's great to be back.
All right, so first up this week, this website 24/7 Wall Street came out with a list of America's drunkest cities. They had some criteria. Wisconsin, I think it was 11 of the top 20 drunkest cities in the country, according to this. And you wrote about this, Rob. What can you tell us about this, this not really a study exactly, but this top 20 list?
Yeah, so there's something to it. So I wrote about this, that we have a lot of drunk cities in Wisconsin. I guess that's not probably a shock to many people. So there's something to this. This is just some website, right? Where they got their data is from this massive public health survey called the County Health Rankings and Roadmaps. And this is like a very good public health data source. It's from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the University of Wisconsin Population Health Institute, and they do this big giant survey measuring a lot of different types of health factors, longevity, obesity, and excessive drinking is one of them. And what they find is that overall, 23% of Wisconsin adults reported excessive drinking, which is either binge drinking in the last month or reporting what they call heavy drinking on average every day, which is a few drinks if you have it every day is heavy drinking. So that's where the public health data comes from. And what this website, 24/7 Wall Street, did is look at the counties, look at the largest cities in the counties, and then count the number of taverns per capita in those cities. And from there, they get drunkest cities. So it's a little questionable, but I do think that there's no doubt that there's something to it. And having seen our web traffic this week, I can tell you that it may be the very biggest story of the week, according to the internet.
And you were a little dismayed by some of the social media response here in Wisconsin to this thing, naming 11 different cities as among the drunkest, Wisconsin cities as among the drunkest in the country.
Yeah, so people love it, and it kind of raises a it's not the healthiest practice, right? I mean, I think we can say binge drinking is not a good thing to do for your body. But also, you know, what I wrote is it's not just that Wisconsinites love drinking; it's that Wisconsinites love drinking, and there's something about how the state defines itself, and it just is our self-image and the way that we're seen by others that really came out in a massive response to this sort of half bogus listicle.
Right, and we're dealing with some very real issues related to drinking in Wisconsin, drunk driving among them, binge drinking, as you mentioned. Do you think that attitude of liking drinking and loving that we like drinking in the state, that might stand in the way of putting a dent in these problems?
I mean, it's a public health problem, right? This is the way it is, right? Moderate drinking is quite healthy. It's a fine thing to do. Have fun, be safe. But heavy drinking is really bad for you. And drinking and driving kills hundreds of people in the state every year, and it's worse here than elsewhere. So, I mean, it's I don't want to be a total wet blanket, right? I actually don't drink myself, but I think it's fine for other people if they want to do it. But yeah, there is a real public health issue, and you kind of get this, sort of har-har, this is hilarious response that I guess I will cop to. I will admit, I'll be a little bit of a wet blanket. It's a little dismaying.
And in the response before we move on from this, Rob, did you also see people saying, this is a problem, we're worried about this, we're not celebrating these results?
For sure. And I think there's a sort of a push-pull, right? People people want to, there's people who want to be critical of this aspect of Wisconsin's culture, and there's people who want to revel in it, and there's sort of people who mix the two or go back and forth between the two. What I found interesting was just what it revealed about how still to this day, how important, how in some ways, like it or not, central to Wisconsin's self-image, this our drinking reputation still is.
We're rounding up the week's news in Wisconsin with Rob Mentzer from the USA Today Network Wisconsin. Let's go to Waukesha now, Rob. The plan there to get water from Lake Michigan because of water quality problems in that area. It cleared a hurdle this week, but it's still not done yet. What happened this week?
Yeah, so this has been a long time coming. This is a this is a complicated matter, and in order to get diverted water from Lake Michigan, you have to get approval of all the Great Lakes states and a couple of Canadian provinces. So this week that group voted to approve the city's plan, provided that it meets a bunch of conditions. They are things like Waukesha had requested 10.1 million gallons of water per day. That has to go down to 8.2 million gallons. The city has to cut back on the proposed areas that would actually be served under this proposal. But still, I think that a 9-0 vote is seen as a good sign for those who want to see this water diversion go forward as they go into the governors are going to vote on it in late June.
And that's the next step, and that, as I understand it, unless this goes to the courts or something, would be the final step if the governors of all the states and provinces, for that matter, sign off on this.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to say that it looks good with they could have, the environmentalists and people who opposed this deal were lobbying hard for it to be rejected at this step. So things would have to reverse a lot for that to change. This would be the first U.S. city since 2008 that is not actually on one of the Great Lakes to receive approval for a water diversion. And I think that it's not hard to understand necessarily, I guess. The concern is, this is why there is a Great Lakes Compact. The concern is, if you grant this one, do you grant more, and does it end up with hurting the water situation? That's why the Great Lakes Compact exists. But apparently Waukesha, in this case at least, satisfied the other states, except for, it should be said, Minnesota. Minnesota abstained from the vote, but satisfied anyway 9 of the other parties that its proposal could be workable.
And finally this week, U.S. Representative Jim Sensenbrenner from Menominee Falls here in Wisconsin introduced a bill tackling the country's asset forfeiture laws. Now, first of all, what are those? What is the asset forfeiture situation?
Right. So asset forfeitures are the rules by which the police can seize property or cash when they arrest someone. So the way to understand it is, if the police go in and grab a suitcase full of drug money, and the person they've arrested is a drug kingpin, and that person is arrested and sent to jail, you wouldn't give that guy back his drug money. The problem is that it doesn't always happen that way. The police also seize stuff from people who are never convicted, maybe even never charged. They seize, there are horror stories about how, sort of how far this can go, where it has happened that a family's home was taken. This was not in Wisconsin, it was in Missouri, but still, a family's home was taken because a teenager that lived there that was arrested and charged with selling marijuana from the porch of the home. So this is a bill that is designed to limit the instances where asset forfeitures can apply, where the cops can take that stuff in the course of an investigation.
As I understand it, this does happen here in Wisconsin, usually a local police department in conjunction with a federal Department of Justice program, that some of that seized money or seized property ultimately benefits the local police department.
Absolutely, yes, it does happen in Wisconsin. There was a state bill introduced this year that would have done made some of the same types of changes as far as just raising the bar for what property police can keep. It happens in a lot of places, and Wisconsin is one place where it happens. What advocates point out of this reform is that police fund drug task forces or other types of operations operational needs with the money, and that just as a system, as a systematic matter, that provides an incentive to maybe seize stuff, you know, in ways that that a neutral party might not approve.
And briefly, Rob, as we wrap up, Congressman Sensenbrenner, generally regarded as a conservative Republican, this is an issue that liberal groups and congresspeople around the country have been concerned about. Is this some place where we'd see bipartisan teamwork on a law like this?
It's one of these interesting bills, right? Absolutely. It for sure is a left-right coalition on it. Conservative Republicans will like it on kind of on less government grounds, personal liberty grounds. And it's also something that is seen as a civil rights issue. Often in a lot of cases, the communities that are hit hardest by these asset forfeitures are, people of color or disenfranchised, communities. And so it's seen as something that that a lot of liberals like. There's a lot of hurdles to get by. There's a lot of law enforcement advocates who say that the funds are necessary. But yeah, this is for sure one of these kind of interesting left-right coalitions.
Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
Hey, thanks.
That's Robert Mentzer with USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau, rounding up the biggest stories from around the state this week in our Wisconsin News Roundup.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, there's been growing concern about discrimination in the so-called sharing economy after the hashtag Airbnb While Black brought out complaints of racial discrimination when booking short-term stays through the hotel alternative Airbnb.
First, the House floor erupted in a partisan shouting match yesterday over an amendment to protect the LGBT community from discrimination.
The amendment would have reversed a previous day's vote that overturned President Obama's executive order aiming to protect LGBT workers. Democrats have accused Republicans of foul play and arm twisting that resulted in a number of Republicans switching their votes, killing the amendment in the end by one vote.
Well, joining us now to make sense of the drama is Paul Singer, politics editor for USA Today. Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, Veronica, how are you?
Doing well, thanks. And I understand you're actually Washington correspondent now. Is that right, Paul?
Indeed. I've given up the editor title.
Well, tell us what happened yesterday in this House amendment vote.
You know, the most important thing to remember about this whole thing, Veronica, is that Republicans and Democrats sometimes speak different language about the same topic. And they talk past each other. And so there is a significant argument about exactly what was at stake in this vote and whether or not President Obama's executive order was in fact in jeopardy. But what happened just sort of on the floor is Democrats wanted an amendment that said nothing in this bill shall contradict the president's executive order, which said that any federal contractor has to protect the rights of gay, lesbian, and transgender employees. Now, the vote appeared at one point to have, the amendment appeared to have enough votes to pass. But anybody amongst your listeners who watches the House floor regularly knows that the clock goes to zero. And then a lot of stuff still continues to happen. Nobody in the House seems to really care that they've run out of time to vote. And somewhere around the end of the timeline here, votes started to change. Six votes, Republican votes, switched from supporting this amendment, which was supposedly to support Obama's executive order. They switched to opposing the amendment, so the amendment died. And Democrats fell into a fury. They said that Republicans were twisting arms, they were keeping the vote open, they were basically cheating, and stole a victory from the Democrats, and, by the way, some Republicans voted with the Democrats, that they say would have protected the rights of gays and lesbians.
So looking at those six votes and the time in which they flipped, what do we know about what happened, why they flipped?
Well, you know, we don't know much. The allegation is that the Republican majority leader was basically on the floor twisting arms and saying, no, you have to go and change your vote from yes to no. And it appears that what happened is in that period of time, six Republicans went ahead and changed their votes from yes to no. Now, there are procedures for doing this, and this is one of the reasons the Democrats are so mad. You can change your vote. in the House of Representatives do it all the time. But in theory, there are procedures where at that late stage, after the time limit has basically closed, to change your vote, you have to go down to the well of the House and fill out a little card and hand it to the clerk, and the clerk has to announce that you have changed your vote, and it becomes sort of a public record. In this case, that did not happen. And Democrats say it is cowardice of those Republicans who changed their votes to not have a public record of it.
Right, and Paul Ryan has come under fire from Democrats because of that, of not going in the regular order of things. What is your sense, Paul, about why that particular rule was not honored yesterday or unfolded differently?
Well, because the House majority has the ability and, I guess the right is the wrong thing to say, but they have the ability to do whatever they want to. It's been this way for years. The Senate has pretty clear procedures and protections for the rights of the minority. The House doesn't. And in fact, in the Senate, when you change your vote, there's actually a way that it is publicly recognized because the Senate votes are all tallied by hand. And so those tallies come up to the press room, and we can see where a vote has been crossed out and changed to the other side. In the House, it's done by electronic voting device, and basically the rules for all of this are essentially at the mercy of the majority.
And Democrats were heard. As you said, there was outrage yesterday. Democrats could be heard chanting shame, shame to those who switched their votes. And here's a listen to what it sounded like yesterday. And Paul, what was Paul Ryan's response to what happened and the criticism that came his way after that happened?
Well, their point is this bill is what's called the Military Construction and Veterans Affairs Appropriations Bill. I mean, it's basically, a bill that is necessary to pay for a bunch of military construction projects, a bunch of veterans projects. And Paul Ryan said, look, this vote is about our veterans. It's about our military. It's about moving forward on those policy issues. We're not going to get dragged down into this dispute over, politics and gay rights. And essentially, they're just sort of blowing past it and saying, this was not a big deal, and what matters is getting the appropriations bill passed. Now, this gets more complicated because there's actually this whole amendment was in reaction to an amendment to another bill that had passed the night before. So now there's two pieces of legislation that are under argument.
And so what happens next with the way that these have been flipping back and forth, or at least trying to be?
Well, once again, God bless our U.S. Congress. The appropriations process and the other bill, the defense authorization process, still requires both agreement by both the House and the Senate, which then has to go to the president for signature. And the president is not going to sign either of these bills, and the Democrats in the Senate are going to oppose both of them. And so I would be surprised to see any of this become law. But you never know. And I suspect also that Democrats are going to make several more attempts on other appropriations bills to insert the same language, saying the president's executive order on gay rights and transgender employment shall be upheld. And I suspect several more attempts by Republicans to make the case that, A, that's not necessary language, and, B, the prior amendment does not actually contradict the president's executive order.
I'm talking to USA Today's Paul Singer about yesterday's vote on the U.S. House floor over LGBT protections. And, Paul, I want to circle back to something you said right away when we started. You said sometimes the Democrats and the Republicans in Washington talk past each other.
Right.
Are you implying that there was, I don't know, some sort of political misunderstanding that happened, that perhaps Republicans were not as committed to passing this as they seemed, and Democrats did not understand this? How would you say it played out?
I'm saying it's two different agendas. In the Republican agenda, it's about religious freedom. And in the 2016 elections, you're going to hear a lot about this from the Republicans, about religious freedom and the freedom for religious organizations to hold their beliefs and to live out their beliefs, even if their beliefs may be that gay marriage, for instance, is bad. And for Democrats, that's not about religious freedom. That's about discrimination against gays. And the reason this whole thing is a problem is that the underlying original amendment was intended by the sponsor. He says just to reinstate and reassert existing protections for religious groups getting federal contracts. The Democrats say that the language he used did not do that at all, and in fact was an attack on gay rights. So is this about religious freedom, or is this about anti-gay discrimination? It depends on who you're talking to, and getting to the bottom of that is very, very difficult because the language is so convoluted in the laws.
And Paul, as we wrap up, what would you say that this particular exchange in the House yesterday says about where the country is, where our politicians are on this conversation about LGBT protections?
Well, I think it says, if nothing else, that it is going to be an extraordinarily hot political topic for the next 11 months. We are going to spend this year arguing a lot about gay rights, about the rights of religious organizations and religious people to believe that gay marriage is not sanctioned by God, basically. And if that is their belief, what are their rights to act on that? And conversely, what are the rights of gays to be married? And it also sort of spills over in this bathroom question about, you know, transgender use of bathrooms. This is two different worldviews at clash, and it's going to continue to be at clash in the public sphere.
Paul, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Veronica. We will.
That was Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up after 7, it's the political junkie. Ken Rudin and his guests look at the road to the Democratic convention and how far Bernie Sanders is going to take his campaign. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, more than 50 years ago, the Civil Rights Act outlawed discrimination on the basis of race, religion, and national origin at public places. These include hotels, taxis, restaurants, theaters, and other public accommodations.
Since that law was passed, the economy has changed a lot, and a new sector has appeared alongside brick-and-mortar businesses, the sharing economy. And services like Airbnb in particular have come under scrutiny lately as people have complained about discrimination.
A study from the Harvard Business School found evidence that Airbnb guests with names that would be perceived as distinctively black names are less likely to be accepted by hosts. And the Twitter hashtag Airbnb while black has brought out stories from black travelers who have felt discriminated against when trying to book on Airbnb.
The conversation has sparked a push for companies like Airbnb to do more to protect their customers from racial discrimination, as well as calls for anti-discrimination laws to catch up with the sharing economy. Joining us now is Nancy Leong. She's an associate professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. Her work focuses on constitutional rights and public accommodation laws. Nancy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start off by talking about exactly what the current public accommodation laws are in the United States.
Sure. So the issue here is that most of our civil rights laws that are designed to prevent race discrimination were passed in the 1960s, or really decades before that. And as you mentioned, those are meant to protect against discrimination by hotels, you know, restaurants, taxis, those kinds of businesses. Those are what we call public accommodations. Those laws are not always a good fit for the businesses that have emerged recently as part of the sharing economy, like Airbnb and Uber and other businesses where the business is not, for example, providing a hotel room, but rather connecting somebody who has a room available with somebody who needs a room. And so the public accommodation laws that we have now are designed to prevent discrimination in particular types of businesses, you know, hotels, restaurants, taxis. Obviously, Airbnb, Uber, Lyft, those businesses weren't around at the time these laws were passed, and so the laws don't necessarily speak directly to them.
Right. These sharing economy businesses are spreading across the country. If they're not in particular towns and cities yet, they will be soon. But for that individual who's, say, renting out their room for a couple of days or giving a ride via Uber, the law treats them as an individual making this decision to do it, not as a business covered by the civil rights law. Is that right?
Well, I think it's complicated, and it's not entirely clear the way that courts are going to treat this yet. I think that one of the critical questions is what you have touched on. So is the relevant business Airbnb as a whole, or is it the individual who makes a decision to rent out, say, a room in her house or an apartment that she only stays in part of the year, something like that?
Let's talk a little bit about what's been happening on the ground. What stories have you heard about how this might be playing out on the ground as people try to get a ride or to rent out their house or to rent a house? What's happening?
Well, so there's been a lot of talk about Airbnb in particular. And earlier this week, on Tuesday, the first lawsuit that I'm aware of was filed alleging race discrimination. And what had happened in this case was that a man who was black attempted to rent a property that he saw listed as available on Airbnb. He was told by the landlord of the property that it wasn't available on the dates that he was looking for. So he kept looking on the website, noticed that it was still listed as available, and felt a little bit suspicious about this and created a profile with a white profile picture. Asked whether the room was available and was immediately told that it was. And so he's filed a lawsuit, not only on behalf of himself, but he has filed it as a class action, saying that he represents many, many other people who have had similar experiences. And of course, on Twitter and other social media, there are a lot of anecdotal reports of this same kind of thing happening.
If this is something that had been done by a traditional landlord, and you hear stories of these things happening well after the passage of the Civil Rights Act, or a taxi company delivery deliberately avoiding neighborhoods, this is something that would go to court, and in most cases, is that something that would be successful in court, challenging that kind of behavior?
Yes, I think it would depend on what the evidence is and exactly what happened and what the person is able to prove. Of course, you'd have to show that it wasn't all a misunderstanding and things like that. But this is the sort of thing that, for example, if a hotel engaged in this kind of behavior, it absolutely would not fly.
What do you think is the significance of the class action nature of this lawsuit? Is there, do you think, a big enough groundswelling of people facing this kind of possible discrimination that this could be something that ends up being quite large?
I think it could potentially be quite large. I read the Airbnb While Black hashtag on Twitter with a lot of interest and concern, and some people had stories that were very similar to the story that this gentleman in Washington, D.C. had, this person who has filed the class action. And so I think there are many people who would say that they are similarly situated to him, which of course is a prerequisite for a class action. And of course, that's just the people who are on Twitter. There are also other kinds of discrimination that might be that might be of concern. So for example, perhaps somebody books a room successfully, but then later the landlord cancels on them. Or maybe they book the room successfully, they go to the property, and they're treated badly while they're there, right? So there's a whole spectrum of behavior that could potentially be included in a class action lawsuit. Now, I don't know exactly how big this lawsuit is going to end up becoming, but it is the first one, and it's gotten a lot of attention lately, so I do think the potential is there.
We're talking to Nancy Leong from the University of Denver. She teaches law there. She's a professor of law there, looking at civil rights law in the age of the so-called sharing economy. Companies like Uber, Lyft, Airbnb. Do civil rights laws apply there? Is discrimination currently legal? Courts deciding could end up in legislatures. Nancy, gets even more subtle than some of the things we've been talking about in a paper you recently co-wrote. You give the example of, I think, a black user of Uber finding, or maybe it was Lyft, I can't remember, but finding out that he has a rating as a customer. And it's lower than all of his white colleagues. So it could be that a cumulative series of discriminatory ratings by people participating in these programs could lead to discrimination, which would sound like it'd be very hard to prove as discrimination.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the challenges that the sharing economy is going to have to confront, or that public accommodation laws that apply to the sharing economy are going to have to confront. So for any users who might not be familiar with these platforms, Airbnb and Uber and many other sharing economy businesses use what's called a bi-directional rating system, meaning that so for example, with Uber, the driver would rate the passenger, and then the passenger would rate the driver. Well, there's been a lot of research done by social scientists which shows that rating systems over time in the aggregate, on average, tend to rate people of color lower than white people. And so there's an argument to be made that what these businesses are doing, Airbnb and Uber and other sharing economy businesses are doing by building this rating system into their platform is placing both, in the case of Uber, both black drivers and black passengers at a potential disadvantage if they end up receiving lower ratings over time.
So looking at that question of anonymity and ratings, what do you think possible solutions could be looking for to kind of get at these questions that you're talking about of implicit bias, things that may be hard to recognize in ourselves or others and even harder to prove?
So I think that one thing that gives me a lot of cause for optimism about the ability of the sharing economy to deal with discrimination is the fact that you can change the platform, right? You can redesign the platform in order to minimize some of these things. So, for example, right now, Airbnb encourages its users to post a picture of themselves and to use their real first name. Now, that's not necessary, right? Both of those things would tend to trigger implicit bias, as you mentioned. It might tend to trigger subconscious discrimination, and that doesn't necessarily have to be a feature of the platform. I think that Uber has actually taken some positive steps in this regard recently. My understanding is that in at least some cities, Uber has redesigned its app so that drivers don't see what neighborhood someone is going to until after they've decided whether to pick them up or not. So, for example, prior to that, there were a lot of reports of people who were going to predominantly black neighborhoods as their destinations, saying that they were having a really hard time getting somebody to pick them up. Well, if the driver doesn't know what the destination is in advance, then there's not that possibility for discrimination. So I think that that is a proactive thing, an example of a proactive thing that a company is doing to address this.
We're talking to Nancy Leong right now, associate professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law, about civil rights and discrimination in the age of services like Airbnb, Uber, and Lyft.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used some of these sharing services that we're talking about as a rider, a driver, a renter, or somebody renting out your place? How do you see discrimination actually playing out or potentially playing out in the way it's used? Do the laws need to catch up? Do the courts need to weigh in? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And if you've used these things, do you think about how you present yourself on these apps and what people might think of you? Call in now at 800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation with Nancy Leong, associate professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. And we're talking about discrimination and civil rights laws in the sharing economy, services like Airbnb, Uber, and Lyft.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you used things like Airbnb or Uber or Lyft? You've been a host, a driver, or somebody who's signed on to receive services. Have you seen discrimination there? Do you see the potential for racial discrimination? What would be useful to help fix that? Does sharing information like your picture and name help build trust, or does it create opportunities for discrimination? Should Congress weigh in ultimately, or the courts? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll bring a caller on now. We've got John on the line in Milwaukee. John, hi.
Hey, guys. Listen to your show all the time. Thank you for the great info you bring to the table. And I just wanted to dispute your guest's claim that it's a good thing to have a driver, like, be blind to their destination when they're picking someone up. I mean, you know, that pizza driver down in Racine just got killed. He's got four kids. He's delivering a pizza in a not-so-good neighborhood, and he's dead. So, I mean, I think it's not – I mean, that to me is unjust to the driver. So how about the rights of the driver to know where he's going, because there are risks associated with that job, and they should have a right to know that?
John, thanks for the call. I mean, so should the driver in this case, Nancy, have the right to know where he or she is going to be asked to take their guest, their patron, worry that it's a dangerous area, or maybe just worry that it's a little far outside of where they want to go?
Sure. I do think that the driver has some rights in this situation, and Uber actually allows for that. Drivers are allowed to cancel a certain number of requests. I think, I think there's some variety from city to city, but the driver can do that. There's a penalty associated with it. But I think the more important question that we need to think about here is the idea that nobody is forcing the driver to be a driver. But once the driver has entered the marketplace, right, he's agreed to treat people equally, to not engage in discrimination. And if you categorically refuse to drive people to predominantly black areas, that translates to discrimination against people who are black.
And do you think the people who enter into these, whatever it may be, whether it is Uber or Lyft or whether it's renting their home out, do you think that they're informed enough to know that they are maybe not an individual but more of a business in a certain case? Do they know what laws they're subject to?
I think that they should, because Airbnb and Uber and these other businesses have very extensive and explicit statements as part of the contract that you sign when you agree to participate in the Airbnb economy or the Uber economy, where you say that you're not going to discriminate. All of these companies make that very clear. And so if you, for example, enter into an agreement with Airbnb saying that you're going to offer your property and make it available, and either knowingly or subconsciously you don't make it available to people of a particular race, then you are engaging in discrimination and you're also violating the terms of your contract with the company.
I wonder, Nancy, we see local governments trying to come up with regulations and ordinances on these sharing economy applications. We've seen state governments weigh in, sometimes overriding those local laws. At some point, are we going to need some kind of federal laws clarifying how civil rights protections apply to these different kinds of businesses?
I would say that we will. And the reason is that Title II is our landmark public accommodation legislation. And this made an enormous difference in the lives of so many people of color when it was passed back in 1964 as part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But that legislation, by its explicit language, is very much tied to these various physical locations, again, hotels, restaurants, taxis, movie theaters, stadiums, all of these businesses that are physical locations. And there's really nothing in there about the internet or that would automatically apply to the internet, even though so much commerce takes place online now. And I do think that is something that public accommodation laws should evolve to address. Now, whether that will be some sort of legislative amendment, I think that that would probably be the fastest and easiest way and would make it clear for all 50 states at once. On the other hand, a court might interpret the existing statute to cover businesses like Airbnb or Uber or Lyft. So that's another way that an update could take place. So there's a few different avenues there, right? It could take place at the federal level through Congress, or it could take place at the federal level through courts.
Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Laura with us in Eau Claire. Laura, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And I guess the point that I wanted to make in my own experience was that I have experienced gender bias with using Airbnb. I found that when I was trying to obtain rentals under my name, I wasn't able to, although they were still available. When I went to use my boyfriend's account, then I was allowed to rent.
Interesting, Laura. And Nancy, what about that? We've been talking about this in terms of racial discrimination, but I can imagine there are all kinds of things that could happen. There's gender. What if you're a Republican and a Bernie Sanders supporter wants to rent from you if you Google them on social media? What about issues that go a little broader than race?
Yeah, so there are certain classifications of identity that our courts and our policymakers have said are deserving of heightened scrutiny when they are the subject of discrimination. Race is one. Ethnicity is another. Sex and gender are also included. Religion is another one. Some of the other things that you mentioned are not necessarily included. But there are certain categories that we look at them more skeptically when it appears that there's been some sort of discrimination. Now, to go to Laura's comment about experiencing discrimination when she has attempted to rent as opposed to as a man, you know, of course I can't speak to her specific experience, but social science evidence has shown that in many instances it is more difficult for a single woman to do things like rent property than a single man. And of course that may vary by region, that may vary depending on the property. But I think that there is some evidence out there to support that it's not just in Laura's head, right? That there could be something going on here with gender. And the same is true of some other identity categories as well, in addition to race.
So it seems like there's almost a race here, Nancy, between the courts weighing in on this, government weighing in, and the companies themselves, these so-called sharing economy companies themselves, coming up with a solution on this. Where do you think the answer, if any, is going to come from?
Well, I think ideally it would be everybody working together. And I do think that some of the largest sharing economy businesses have already made some really positive steps. I mentioned the changes that Uber has made. I think that Airbnb is taking many of these complaints seriously. And so I think that obviously the easiest thing that could happen to prevent this would be for the companies to redesign their websites to make it more difficult for discrimination on the basis of race, gender, religion, sexual orientation, categories like that, to make it more difficult for that type of discrimination to take place. And I mentioned, you know, some things like profile pictures and racially identifiable names as features that could be eliminated.
And so that's where we'll leave it. Thanks so much to Nancy Leong, associate professor at the University of Denver Sturm College of Law. We've been talking about the sharing economy and discrimination laws.